Catherine Hammack, Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. Madam Secretary, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here today.
Good to see you too, Francis.
We've talked about, before we went on the air, some of the travels that you've undertaken lately, and we discussed a series of stops that you've made where you've been seeing some of the things that your colleagues in the Army are doing, especially regarding climate change and how it affects readiness and so on. Tell me what you're seeing as you're traveling about.
Well, I think we're all seeing challenges faced by flooding in some parts of the United States, and then drought in other parts of the United States. And those affect the military as well. Those are things that we need to address. The variation in rain can impact our mission. It can impact our training. If it's too dry a period, that can impact our mission because we may not want to use our training ranges because of the potential to spark fire or forest fires. So climate change really does have an impact on the Army mission. In addition, we know it's going to shape our operating environment and our roles and missions because although climate change effects do not directly cause conflict, they can act as accelerants of instability or conflict around the world.
The very basic things that people need, food, clothing, shelter, and the ability to move about are some of the things that climate change experts say can be dramatically affected. Those obviously are all not just national security issues here in the United States, but in potential places around the world where the Army and your fellow branches may be called to go and serve.
Absolutely. And so we look at it in two ways, both adaptation and mitigation. So adaptation is where we might look at our construction or our land use and change it. Maybe we'll build something at a slightly higher elevation or further from the shoreline. That's part of our mitigation of effects of climate change. But adaptation takes a look at, that's adaptation. Mitigation is things we can do to perhaps slow down climate change. And mm-hmm. That's where we are looking at renewable energy or reduction in water use. We are looking at increased use of wind and solar, decreased consumption of energy, various ways that we can mitigate the effects so that we don't have to adopt as many adaptation moves. So that, but you look at some of the other services, the Navy, for them, adaptation is one of the challenges since mm-hmm. they have a lot of docks that are fixed. And if water rises, they're going to have to do something about it.
We'll talk about some of the gains that you've made in the move toward net zero and later on in the program. The renewable energy piece of the mitigation element that you just discussed, you talked about some solar things that you're working on the last time you were on the program, and I think there's a sense that we're starting to turn the corner as far as demonstrating return on investment on renewable energy, where it's not more expensive to do it, and the only reason we're doing it is because there's a noble end. We're moving toward an effective replacement value for the amount of money that we're spending. Are we still seeing that trend continue?
Absolutely, because we're seeing that we can buy green power at the same cost of brown power. So in Georgia, we're working with Georgia Power. And in partnership with Georgia Power, they're going to build about 100 megawatts of renewable energy on our bases in Georgia and sell it to us at the same price as brown power. And that's going to increase the resiliency of the installation. That's going to go toward climate change mitigation. And it's going to help levelize the cost because, you know, we've seen volatile utility costs that are dependent upon the cost of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. Is that similar to the one that you told me about when you were here last time that I believe was in California, where you were building a solar array on an energy company is building a solar array on an Army base? You get the energy for a period of time and they own the infrastructure. Is that the same
kind of
deal?
That's in Arizona, Fort Huachuca.
Okay, yes.
And yes, that's going to be about a 20 megawatt solar array, one of the largest in the Department of Defense, until these ones in Georgia are mm-hmm. built, because we're finding that as the cost of producing the panels comes down, we are able to, in partnership with utilities and the private sector, build a lot more.
Are those agreements structured in the same ways, or are there various multiple vehicles that you use to get to the end that you want?
There's multiple vehicles. One of the first ones that we thought we'd use primarily is a power purchase arrangement, where we put it out to contract and the private sector agrees to build on the Army installation, and we agree to buy power produced for the next 20 plus years. There are several new manners. One is which we're using with Georgia Power, whereas we grant Georgia Power an easement. They build the renewable energy facility on the Army land, and we buy the renewable energy from them at the same market rate that we are buying brown power.
Mm-hmm.
So that turns out it's a slightly shorter contracting process. The third way is enhanced use lease, where the contractor might install more than we need on the Army installation. A portion of it, the power comes to the Army or is deeded back to the Army at a fairly low cost, and the balance they are selling out on the market.
And so the benefit to them is, in all of these cases, is they build and manage the infrastructure, and the benefit to you is that you receive the power at a guaranteed rate that's market competitive. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, and it increases the resiliency of our installations. And as we talked about earlier, it provides some mitigation against the effects of climate change, and it's good for this nation.
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to go next, because we have talked on a number of occasions about the raw numbers, and certainly they're important with where we are budget-wise, where the Defense Department is. But I can't imagine that there aren't intangibles, and you've touched on there just a couple of them, that are equally important when it comes to renewable energy and the efforts that you're making in that area.
For us, it's really about securing the mission and mission effectiveness. One of the challenges that we have seen is over the last 10 years, we've seen a fourfold increase in the number of power interruptions to our bases. And quite often our bases aren't built in the middle of a commercial sector. They're built out in the middle of nowhere, the end of the power line or the cul-de-sac of energy. So if anything happens upstream, we lose power. When we construct a power plant, a renewable energy facility on the base, that reduces the pressure on the line and allows more power to be available in the community because we are producing the power that we need at point of use. So it really is a benefit both to the base and to the community in increasing resiliency and reducing stress and strain on aging and vulnerable power lines.
Are there particular kinds of renewable energy that are maybe edging out in front of others as maybe preferred methods, or is it really individually dependent on each location and what suits it environmentally?
It's very dependent upon geography, but right now we have a lot of solar projects that are in the pipeline, and that is because solar panel prices have been reduced as that technology has matured. We are also seeing some biomass facilities that we're looking at where they might be producing energy from clippings or leftovers from the timber industry or from agriculture. And we're looking at a few wind projects, but the challenges with wind is because they're very tall, they can get into our flight airspace. And airspace is something that we value highly.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not seeing as many wind projects right now as we thought we might.
The Net Zero Energy Installation Summary Report for fiscal 2013 is out. Give me a thumbnail, please. Remind me of the net zero concept and what you're attempting to do there, what that means, and then a highlight or two from what you're learning about this year.
Absolutely. Net zero really has three parts. Net zero energy, produce as much energy on site as you consume in a year, but the first step to net zero is reduce your consumption so that you can get everything in balance. Net zero water is consume as much water as you are able to inject back into the local aquifer so that you keep your water table in balance. And it's really about balance there. And net zero waste is just like it sounds. Don't send any waste to landfill. Mm-hmm. So the net zero program is really about getting your resource consumptions into balance. But the net result of it is it reduces our operating costs. It's more sustainable. It increases the resiliency for our installation, and it contributes to climate change mitigation.
The report that we'll learn more about that as it comes out. But those three areas, are there areas there where you see among energy, waste, and water more potential for growth than others, or are they progressing kind of all along together at the same time?
Energy is an area that we've discussed a lot before, and that's a big focus. And when you say net zero, many people think it only applies to energy. Mm. But certainly with California early announcing drought conditions, really before we got into the summer months, people becoming much more aware of water and the fact that we have to manage our water consumption and we have to manage our water recharge so that we can keep the environment that we operate in balance.
I want to go back to the renewable energy discussion we started on in the last part of our conversation, Madam Secretary, because you mentioned at the end of that discussion that wind, solar, biofuel, and some others are renewable energy sources that you're focused on. I want to call your attention to the recent announcement of the 2014 Readiness and Environmental Protection Integration Challenge Award winners. One of them was at Fort Huachuca in Arizona. And as I read about this and then you and I discussed it during the break, it strikes me that the goal there is to preserve a renewable resource that maybe we don't think about always as renewable. Is that right?
Well, water is that resource. Mm-hmm. And in Arizona, just like California, they're facing challenges with water. In this case, at Fort Huachuca, there's two endangered species that their habitats border the base. And in order for that species to survive, we need to ensure that the surface water is recharged to a level that's sustainable. So the REPI challenge was a partnership, a collaboration with the private sector, with NGOs, with state and other federal agencies to determine how we can preserve water rights in the state so that they don't get overtaken by private sector development and so that the species can survive. And it's amazing that the Army has stewardship over 192 endangered species, many of which are only found on Army installations. And that's because we have about 14 million acres of land that we steward. Mm-hmm. So we watch over water. We watch over species that are that the endangered species like, species mm-hmm. that the species like. Sounds weird yes. to say, but sometimes you have to, in Georgia, have a longleaf pine because the red calcated woodpecker only habitats the longleaf pine. Mm. So therefore, we preserve the largest tracts of longleaf pine in the state so that that bird has habitat.
Back in Fort Huachuca, they'll receive a REPI Challenge Award of $4 million, and that will leverage over $9 million in partner contributions. Partners, the note here says Arizona Land and Water Trust, Arizona Department of Energy and Military Affairs, U.S. Agricultural Department, Natural Resources Conservation Service, Bureau of Land Management, and National Fish and Wildlife Foundation in partnership with the Army. That's quite a mix of, you got an NGO in there, you have state organizations, a couple of federal organizations. It's quite a mishmash there to navigate, it sounds like.
It is, and our team on the ground is doing a fantastic job of organizing and bringing the various agencies together to do what's right for the environment and to do what's right for these endangered species. Because when we get things in balance, then we're able to preserve the mission that we have. We're able to do the kinds of training and testing that we need our lands for.
160,000 annual air operations protected reduction of proliferation of electromagnetic interference for 800 square miles of airspace. So that's your readiness component there.
Absolutely.
And prevention of development of up to 1,400 new wells on 5,900 acres of ranch land. So essentially, this land is now set aside. It won't be developed, and so you won't have 1,400 home sites where people might need to plug into the aquifer. Am I reading this all right?
You're reading it right. And the other advantage for this nation is many of these set-asides then become areas that can be used for light recreational use, whether it's hiking or camping or something like that. So it's both preserving our heritage and preserving the environment.
How many of these do you expect to be able to do? Is this something, I mean, there are two in this particular case, but is this kind of partnership scalable to the degree that you would like it to be?
We have similar kinds of relationships all around the United States. And we were in Kentucky a couple of months ago and saw evidence of a similar relationship where they are restoring lands and providing habitat, planting species so that endangered species can survive there. And it only works when you have a great partnership with the community, with the private sector, with other NGOs. And by working collaboratively together, we can do what's right.
You're inviting a comment on the environmental impact of force reductions. The force reduction is something that we'll get into in a future conversation as we talk about base realignment and closure. But I would be remiss if I let you go today before we at least touched on that. That at this point in time is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to all of the issues in your portfolio, isn't it?
It is. And it's interesting because some of these do contribute to each other. So when we do our environmental assessment of force reductions, it actually has a positive impact on the environment because fewer forces will be testing and training at that location. It has a positive impact on energy because fewer forces will use less energy, but then it might have a negative socioeconomic impact on the community because we have less soldiers who are living in the community or utilizing services in the community. So when we do our environmental assessment of force reductions, we have to take all of those environmental factors into account.
We'll get into the discussion of BRAC very, very soon, later in this week, but give me kind of a thumbnail of where the effort stands as you continue and your colleagues continue to make the case for another round of base realignment and closure.
Well, right now, I think the next push is really going to be anchored around our announcement of the next step of force reductions, because as we shrink from what is projected to be a force of 490,000 by the end of 2015 to what's could be a force as small as 420,000 active duty by the end of 2020, those size force reductions are going to mean we have a Swiss cheese of our bases. We have holes in places, buildings that are underutilized that could be a productive use in the commercial sector or in the communities.